The United States of America has an incredibly serious problem, and it ranks right up there with climate crisis. The problem is spreading around the world. It is a disorder that has dire consequences for all of us. Today, we'll give this problem a name and understand what we need to do to address it. Let's talk about excessive wealth disorder. Hey, everybody, I'm Gina Murphy-Darling, and this is Impact Earth Social Justice. Thanks for listening. Let's start by me telling you a little bit about our guest. Joining me to share his thoughts on this very hot topic is Alan Davis. Alan is the director of the Why Not Initiative, a private family foundation social change program to address problems with the democratic process, income and wealth distribution, universal health care, and tolerance. They've got quite a bit of the challenges we face as a country covered. Alan is also a millionaire who is currently a member of the Patriotic Millionaires, which promotes increasing taxes on the wealthy to achieve a fair and growth-oriented tax system. One of his passions in life is to bring about a fairer, more equitable distribution of wealth in our country because he knows that ultimately this increasingly widening gap is ultimately a scenario in which literally nobody wins, including the billionaires. According to one of the most recent studies I read, the rich are truly getting richer, with 10% of U.S. households, 10% representing 70% of all the wealth in the United States of America. And that was at the end of 2018. And I dare say the gap is probably widening when we have the results for 2019. So, Alan, that was a long way of saying thanks so much for being here. And literally for what you're doing to turn around a very big and very powerful ship. I got that visual. It's like, yeah, you have a lot of work cut out for you.
There's a lot of work. Thank you so much, Gina. And yeah, I think you've laid out the problem pretty well. We have this serious problem, which we call excessive wealth disorder, which basically refers to all the bad things that come from too many people having way too much money. And it's put us on the verge of cementing a future as a true plutocracy, a country or a society that's basically governed by the wealthy. And that's what we seem to be experiencing. So it's time to do something about that.
You know, when I was preparing for the show and knowing about your work and all of that, it's really challenging to wrap your head around a lot of the moving parts, because a lot of people think, you know, there's the very wealthy and they get to live the life they want. And it's a very disconnected thought, maybe jealousy, maybe envy, maybe admiration. But it really does impact the health and well-being of all of us. And that's a lot of what I want to cover today, because you get it. And it's including those with the money. They're at risk as well. So how did we get here? That's the big question. It's like, how did we have a plutocracy crisis? The very powerful, extremely rich make a lot of the decisions for themselves and for everyone else. So when did it start? It didn't just happen in the past 2 years, which I would love to blame the current administration for all of this, but yeah, that would be so unfair and unjust and not correct.
Yeah. Well, actually, you know, there's always been a case where the wealthy have had a certain amount of control. But starting in 1980, up until 1980, we had an income tax system that asked the wealthy to pay their fair share of taxes. But starting with President Reagan, we started to cut back on taxing the ultra-rich. And this process of lowering the tax rates for the rich continued for decades, to the point we're now at the lowest tax rate for the rich that we've been possibly in the history of the income tax. And so this has allowed this tremendous accumulation of wealth. And it's come from, you know, in the back in the Reagan days, we had, I think appropriately named, something called the Laffer Curve. And it basically made the case or tried to make the case that if the rich got richer, everybody would benefit. Well, that turns out to be totally false, and we're experiencing that today, where sure, the rich have gotten a lot richer, but the middle and working class basically have been left behind. And so I think your point is correct that if we can fix this problem, we should have a society that has tremendous economic growth, but with shared prosperity. So that's the goal here.
And you, so much for the trickle-down theory, which is a Kool-Aid we were asked to drink for a bit. Like, everybody will have more money, and businesses will have more money, and they'll put it back in the economy. And historically, that is like, you know, I love that expression. I call it BS. It didn't work. It's like, don't drink that Kool-Aid. It's not going to work.
Exactly right.
But with these kind of things, the devil in terms of the kind of change that you're talking about is in the detail. And because you personally know quite a bit about the intricacies of tax law and tax reform, what does a fair and growth-oriented tax system look like? How does it work?
Well, I think the starting place is because a lot of this is, it's been intentionally made complicated, and the public doesn't have a full grasp yet of this, what the problem is and how big the problem is. So the starting place is to understand that we're talking about income and wealth. So these are two different things. Income is the amount that you take in a year, as an example, and that's what you report on your tax return. Okay. That's the income. And then wealth is what you've accumulated after you've taken in this money. So so the approaches to tax policy are trying to address both the income, the annual amount you take in, and the amount of money that you've accumulated, the wealth. So that would be the starting place to think about it. And people don't fully grasp how rich the rich really are. So we see a lot of polling where people are talking about the 1% and this and that. Well, there's a huge difference between the 1%, which is one out of every 100 people,
right,
and the 0.1%, yes, which is one out of 1,000 people.
Yes.
So the point in terms of income, 1% means you're earning somewhere between $400,000 and $500,000, which is very well off. And these are small business owners and professional people, two doctors working in a household, that sort of thing.
Right.
They're well off, but they're not rich. Whereas the 0.1% have income. That means every year they're taking in excess of $2 million. And that's where we get into what we think of as excessive wealth, excessive income. And on the wealth side, how much money people have accumulated there, it's even worse, because we've had this 40-year period where the rich were not paying their fair share in taxes. So
right
now we have, it's a worldwide problem, though. It's the 80 wealthiest people in the world have $2 trillion of, just 80 people have $2 trillion, which is actually the same amount that the 3.5 billion people, the bottom half of the world, have. So 80 rich people have the same as the bottom half of the world. Or here in the U.S., three individuals, Jeff Bezos, Bill Gates, and Warren Buffett, have more wealth than the bottom half of the country. Three people.
And I
more
want
than half.
I want,
it's just,
yeah,
it's unimaginable, right?
Yeah.
And if you think about it, so if you take, so the 0.1%, that cutoff point for the 0.1% is in income is $2 million. And for wealth, it's people who have $25 million or more. So for income, that is each year, the 0.1% have a total income of $1 trillion. Now, a trillion is a little hard for most of us to get our heads around, but that's 12 zeros. It is.
It's mind-boggling. And what I was going to say is I invite everybody listening to just kind of press pause and put their head around what you said, because I agree with you that we don't always recognize it, as I love it, excessive wealth disorder, but there are telltale signs, and some of us know some of them, you know, like racing multi-million dollar yachts, and Jeff Bezos wants to send rockets to the moon. So
right.
But bringing it back to that unimaginable wealth, like I can't even get my head around it. And also I want to comment on your point, $400,000 to $500,000 a year. Most of those people worked hard to get there and they continue to work hard and they do contribute and they do pay taxes. And that's a very comfortable place to live and they deserve it. So that's not what we're talking about at all. And I think that clarity is really important.
Right,
so
that's right.
Let's go back to Bill, Warren, and Jeff Bezos, my three best friends that have worth more than $100 billion. That's Jeff Bezos. More than 50% of households in the United States. From your perspective, and you may not even want to comment on that because it's not to put you on the spot, do you think that all of these three people have EWD, or do you think there's degrees in those people? And it doesn't matter to the extent of what my question is, because my question is, how much power does that give them to take our country in the direction in which they want it to go? It's their agenda that they can make fly, because that is really a lot of money, and money is power. And is that an overreaction on my part? Because you know that I can
absolutely
overreact to things.
No, that's exactly what we're talking about here, that this excessive wealth allows this unique group of individuals to basically control everything. And they do it by a combination of political contributions, where basically we now have a system with a few exceptions where, you know, the rich determine who gets to run for office. And that's a whole nother problem that we have to deal with, but it comes from this excessive wealth. They also control it. This is the part that I find so interesting. They control it through their charitable giving.
Yes.
So you take, I find it kind of interesting. You get a guy like Zuckerberg who goes into Newark and thinks he knows how to solve the education crisis, and then proceeds to completely botch it up. But he wasn't elected to solve our education crisis. There's no group of people who sort of signed off on his plan to do it. But because he has way too much money, he thinks he can go in and do that. That's not the way our society is supposed to work. So I find it interesting that there's this thing called the pledge that that Bill Gates and Warren Buffett are behind, which says that the wealthy are going to, they pledge to give away 50% of their wealth.
Right.
Which is basically going to go to a private foundation that's named after them, which will keep their, legacy
alive, right?
Indefinitely, right? And my question is, well, wait a minute. How about if they gave that 50% back to the government and let the government decide how to spend that money? Now, a lot of people have a reaction, oh, the government can't spend money well, or they're going to waste it. But that's a whole nother topic that we should talk about, because let's think about that. We have 60 million people in this country who don't have access to drinking water. Now, Bezos, Gates, and Buffett are not addressing that problem. We have tens of millions of children who don't have access to childcare or early childhood education. Again, that should be a decision that the public gets to make. Are these our priorities or not? A Green New Deal. I don't see very much money being spent by the rich class on trying to, in fact, as you probably very well know, it's pretty much the opposite, right? That all the money being spent is to prevent environmental regulations,
right,
and slow. So, yeah, that money, I think it's a really kind of, to me, it's sort of a simple question. So if you take the income number, which is $1 trillion a year, I think the question simply is, how much of that money should be moved from people who are buying private jets and super yachts and, you know, by the way, another sign of excessive wealth disorder is this need to have the largest yacht. I mean, really, how many helicopters on a yacht do we really need to have?
Right.
That's kind of a question. But why can't we move some of that $1 trillion back to the government and let's pay for some of these programs? Let's make sure we don't have a Social Security crisis. Let's make sure we have better health care. We have a lot of ways that the government spends money that really does good for our country, and we should be thinking about taking some of that money and using it for the common good.
And it's a perfect segue to these next two questions. The two-part question is, what are your thoughts on why this, it's not just inequality, it's an equity issue, which is very different. Why is it so bad for society? And I think you do believe that it is. Why is it so bad? And why should those rich people be smart enough to get it, that it ultimately will impact their lives and their companies and their workforce? They may think they're untouchable or think they're being benevolent or think they're leaving a legacy. What are your thoughts on why it's so bad for society, and can it ultimately touch them?
Yeah, well, you're right. This is, so excessive wealth disorder, one of the obvious elements of that is income inequality, this great gap between the rich and the poor. And I'm not here to say we should have equality, that is, that everyone should earn the same money or whatever. I'm just saying it's gotten so out of hand that we have to bring it back to, like, normal.
Right.
And the indicators are, so there's been a lot of research and recently some really groundbreaking research that shows that if you have great inequality, all of the social indicators suffer. So, for example, and the United States is at the top end of developed countries in terms of income inequality. So, as a result, we have the worst rankings in terms of life expectancy, lower math and literacy scores, high infant mortality, high homicide rate, extremely high imprisonment, high teenage births, obesity, mental illness, drug and alcohol addiction. And two really interesting indicators are we have very low social mobility, which was the sort of the lifeblood of America. It's that
right.
Notion that if you work hard, you can get ahead.
Right, well, the American dream. Yeah.
Exactly. Doesn't seem to be true anymore. And the last one, which really gets to me, because I don't think people really understand this well enough, trust. We have the lowest, they try to measure how, do you trust your fellow person? And America is like at the low end of the trust scale. And I think it has to do in part with excessive wealth creating a greed mentality, because we live, most of us measure ourselves in comparison to somebody else. And so even if you're earning $500,000, you sort of look to your neighbor who's earning $1 million and think, oh, I'm not doing so well.
Right.
And this kind of, it leads to, well, at least to greed, but it leads to mistrust. So comes back to like what America is supposed to be about, right? It's life, liberty, and happiness. So in terms of life, we're doing poorly in life expectancy, infant mortality, homicides, and drug and alcohol addiction. So we're not fulfilling the American dream. If you think about liberty, we have the highest imprisonment rates, and our democracy is a complete mess. It's completely controlled by money. And happiness, actually, this is particularly interesting, I think, that it turns out that we are a very unhappy society. And particularly the rich are unhappy. So,
so money doesn't
kind
buy
of
happiness.
That's,
yes.
You know, so it's like, okay, you know, and then you add in the greed and trust and mental illness and social mobility, and you see we're not doing a good job on the happiness score either. So your point is correct that if we could start to reduce this incredible disparity between the rich and the and everybody else, that we're all going to be better off. So that's the game plan.
And all of those three people, and there are not many more, obviously, but there are more that aren't as wealthy, but all of them built their wealth, not necessarily on the backs of others, I don't think that's fair, but by employing people to amass that wealth. And if you have people, everybody that I know that's in a service industry business, they can't find enough people to read and write and work computers. They can't
right.
find people that show up on a regular basis because there are other issues they're facing in their family. So to me, it's so obvious that it weakens everything. It's the rising tide is such an appropriate metaphor because it's going to, if they can't hire people to do fulfillment at Amazon, it's going to hurt Jeff Bezos' bottom line. Not enough in my lifetime, but I mean, it really does become a societal sickness that everybody has and no one is really immune to some degree.
Yeah, I think that's totally correct. And, you know, as you alluded to earlier, I mean, they may have a gated community and the kind of electronics in their home that protects them from virtually, you know, like we have blackouts here in California,
Your
Georgia, California.
Shut off.
And, you know, okay, so they have generators to protect them
yes.
for the time being. But at some point, that's not going to be enough. And they are going to, you know, maybe not in their lifetimes. Maybe they think they can escape it. But in their children's lifetimes, and certainly in their grandchildren's lifetime, they're going to be insurmountable problems unless we start to address those now. So, yeah, I totally agree with you. But, you know, and even to the point where, you know, history has shown us that societies have collapsed, major societies have collapsed simply because of income inequality. It happened in Greece. It happened in Rome. It happened in Germany. It's not, this is something that is, for me, it's scary.
Yes.
I don't think it's scary
and
yet
it's real.
In the public mind, but
it's real.
But it's real.
It's yeah. real. So I want to do a little, it's like a mini Gina rant, but there is a question here. So just bear with me for a minute.
Okay.
Because at some point, it became very clear to me that we have really never had a democracy in this country. Churches decided a lot and still do. Now it's people with money. It's lobbyists. They're the ones who are really deciding. To me, I do not believe that I live in a true democracy. So the big question is, and I want to do this kind of like, this is what I thought. So I'm sitting there and I want to get to a place where we, the people, get to decide what's best for us, as you talked about a little bit earlier. So let's just say Bill Gates decides. Everybody decides he's got the most money, so he's going to do what he believes is best for the country. And I'm not picking on Bill, God forbid. But he decides he's going to make it possible for every single child over the age of 6 to have a computer because technology is the way of the future. So what that means to me is that's where the money will flow. That's what people will be investing in. And because I'm a billionaire, I say to Bill, no, Bill, that's not going to work. We really have to go deeper. We really have to look at family systems. Like, what is a good computer to a kid who has rotting teeth or an empty stomach or two siblings that she has to help raise because her mom has to work to keep a roof over her head? It's going to take more time because we have to really rebuild systems and cycles that we have to address, Bill. So come on, let's take a broader view of how to build that. Maybe he'll listen to this podcast, actually. So if Bill or Jeff or Warren get to decide because they have the money, that's really not moving us to a better, higher level of a functioning society. Is that fair for me to even say?
I don't think anyone could say it better. I think it's totally correct. And what's unfortunate, what really saddens me, is that the public in general thinks that they can make a better decision than we, the public, can do it, which is kind of ironic in a way.
Yes.
But and it's totally not correct. And there's so much evidence that it's not correct. I mentioned the Zuckerberg example. It's not correct, but we still believe it. We still worship rich people. It's like, you know, just as you said, so Bill Gates, and again, not picking on
right.
Bill Gates, but at any one of them, but I know what his numbers are, so I can say this. He's sitting at home in his pajamas, earning $10 million a day.
Oh, my God.
And $10 million a day, I'm going, doesn't anybody think there's something wrong with this picture? I mean, I can't be the only. This is crazy. And not only is he earning $10 million a day, he's paying virtually nothing in taxes. So I'm going, no, there's something wrong with this picture. So this is where we need to begin. We need to start putting in place, and the public can make this happen. If their voices are loud enough, if they demand it, the public can make this happen. We can start putting the right, a fair tax on excessive wealth. And we can tax the income, and we can tax the wealth, and we can begin to balance the books so that everybody prospers. We can do this. It's not, your statement is true. It's been controlled by the rich, but we actually can, you know, if we unite, if people get motivated and unite, we can make a difference here. And as a matter of fact, so we've just introduced, I support it, but what's been introduced into Congress is what they call the millionaire surtax.
Okay.
Senator Van Hollen and Brown and Congressman Beyer have introduced it in the Senate and the House, which is the first step to addressing excessive wealth disorder. It's a 10% surtax on incomes over $2 million. Now, a surtax is maybe a fancy name, but basically all it is another tax bracket.
Right.
So if you're earning over $2 million, and only if you're earning over $2 million, you pay an additional 10% on the money you earn over $2 million. But what's unique about the surtax is it taxes both your earned income and the income you make while you're sitting in your pajamas clipping coupons.
$10 million a day.
Yeah, well, that's, you know, obviously he's an extreme case.
Right, right.
But it's true. I mean, I'm in the same league. I don't take a salary from the foundation, so I live off of the income I make from my investments.
And, right.
And I pay a pretty low tax rate on that, and it's not right. So this surtax would begin to address that. And it doesn't seem like a whole lot. It's, you know, it's 10 cents on the dollar above $2 million, but it raises an incredible $650 billion over 10 years. So on an annual basis, say $65 billion, which is enough money right there, just on that tax, to pay for fixing all the water systems in America so that the 60 million people who don't have drinking water right now would have it. Or it could pay for free early childhood education and daycare for all children in America. I mean, that's the scale that we're talking about here. So this is a first step. You know, there'll have to be other things done. Like I happen to be a fan of Bernie Sanders' wealth tax, which is a higher tax than Warren's wealth tax, believe it or not. And because in the, again, we were talking about wealth. If a Warren Buffett has, say, $75 billion, I think there's a question that we have to answer. At the end of the day, at the end of a year, should he have $80 billion, the same $75 billion, or less, $70
billion? Right.
Like, should the tax system maintain his status as a richest, you know, at that level? Or should we start to take some of that back? And I happen to be in the camp that thinks we should start to take some of that back, because at that level, it's not right. It's just that we could do better with that money than what he's doing with it. So,
and what keeps coming to me when you're talking is, it is not liberal, it's not out there, it's not wild and crazy, it's not being a Democrat. It's a scenario where everybody really does win, because, you know, you're only as strong as the weakest link. I can come out with a number of those expressions where, you know, one of the things that Bill Gates really did help a lot with is the eradication of polio globally. And what people don't understand about that, as long as there's still one active case, we all have the risk of dying from polio because it could be carried over on a plane. So the health of one person and the access, you know, the access to clean water, it impacts all of our life. No one is impervious to that. It could impact their children or their grandchildren. And it screams to me, this is smart. Smart people are thinking this, but enough of that rant. Back to you personally.
No, that's not a rant. That's it. Like, you're exactly right.
What are you thinking?
You're exactly right.
Do you think you can live in a bubble and this is not going to impact you or your peers or people you love? So I want to point out that from everything I read in researching this, from knowing you, knowing about some of the organizations you're working with, this is not billionaire bashing, and you don't want to take everybody's money away. It's not Robin Hood. You're not wanting to take it from the rich and give it to the poor. It's really more about an equal distribution. So to you, Alan Davis, who has the luxury of doing what you want to do on any given day, and you said that, you can stay in your pajamas and look out at that beautiful deck from Sausalito. I've done that myself for a day or two. But why are you putting your energy and your passion and your money and your travel and your time into making our country more sustainable and socially just? Why does it matter to you? Why do you care?
Well, I guess I grew up in a, my father was successful, and I grew up in a upper middle class situation and felt privileged. And I guess I somehow, I remember we took a cruise when I was 12 years old that stopped in Caracas, Venezuela. And, you know, on a cruise, you do these excursions one day, you know, for the day. And we got in a taxi and we're driving on the main highway, and on the left side of the road was, we had a guide, and the guide was telling us it was this officer's club, and he was describing this luxurious building for officers and what have you, and he didn't say a word, but on the right side of the road was a hill, and on the hill were people living in shacks. And, you know, I don't even think I would call them tents.
Right.
And I was just, as a 12-year-old, I was devastated by this the contrast, like, you know, how do we live like that? And to be honest with you, I never, ever imagined that we'd be experiencing that here in the United States. But we are, it's starting to look like that.
Yes.
It's, I mean, take San Francisco, for example, where, you know, the multimillionaires are pushing out everybody and housing prices are going crazy and our homeless situation is skyrocketing. So something's not working quite right here. And just seems, so I had a passion for taxes, tax reform. I've done it basically my entire life. I wrote papers, my senior thesis was on tax policy in college. I went to law school to learn tax policy. I started a tax reform group when I graduated law school. I've been doing it for quite a long time, but it's never been as bad as it is now.
Agreed. I mean,
the system is so rigged right now, and we have to unrig it. We have to ask in a very persuasive way. We have to ask wealthy people to pay their fair share so we can all benefit.
So what about your peers? And sometimes I think I live in a bubble because I surround myself very much socially with people that think like I do, especially since the last election. It's like for my own preservation and sanity, because I don't want to argue about things. You're a part of the Patriotic Millionaires. What are your peers? I mean, you hang out with millionaires. Mm. Are they pushing back and saying, Alan, what are you nuts? Let's have another brandy and enjoy our ride, or let's go to, you know, the South Pole and forget about that. Do you have a lot of people, or do you have a sense for where other people who have the ability to say, I have money and I'm willing to go on the line and make some changes?
Well, we're... We are sometimes referred to as traitors to our class, but that's actually not, we're not the traitors really. It's the people who have voted for these tax policies that lower the tax on the rich that are the traitors to their class. But, you know, I think you've said, and it's pretty true, this is not radical stuff that we're talking about here. I mean, maybe historically it sounds or seems radical, and I'm sure there are going to be, rich people who will make it look radical. But this 10% surtax, none of us in the Patriotic Millionaires are going to, it's not, we're not going to take fewer vacations because of this. So this is not, so I don't think this was the surtax part wasn't a big lift, but it's the first time that we have a litmus test for whether people are serious about taxing the rich.
Got it.
And that's really important. So you could go to a congressperson or your senator and say, are you for the surtax or not? We're shorthanding it as the surtax. The bill is actually called the Millionaire Surtax. I call it the growth and shared prosperity surtax, but the surtax, because we don't really have another surtax, so that's shorthand. If you ask somebody, are you for the surtax or not, the answer to that question is, it's unambiguous. You're either for beginning to tax the rich or you're not. And luckily for us, the public is pretty solidly behind this. So its polling numbers are in the high 70s, and that doesn't matter whether you're a Democrat or Republican or independent. So people support this notion that the rich should start paying their fair share of taxes, and this is a good place to start.
It's a great place to start, and it's like I am coming up on what is my last question and grilling of Alan Davis, but most people who listen to our podcasts, and there are thousands of them, they obviously care about the climate crisis and they care about social justice issues. I mean, we are a demographic, and I'm also quite sure that most of them are not millionaires or billionaires. And I can't help but think that many of them who listen to this are saying, That's great. I agree with him. I have a lot of respect for what he's doing. But what the heck can I do about it? And it's that trust issue that you referred to. How can I help bring about this needed change that I know will benefit everyone, including the very rich? What are your reasons for us having hope and to trust that this is the first thing I've heard of, maybe ever, that will lead us on a different path? Give us some hope, Alan. No pressure.
I think there are some good indicators that there is reason for hope. So as you mentioned at the beginning of the program, my two primary interests, as you indicated in the beginning of the program, my two primary interests are democracy and income inequality. And not surprisingly, they are very closely linked. And so the House of Representatives have addressed the democracy issue by passing H.R. 1, which most people thought could never happen. But it addresses most of the issues that we care about in terms of moving us to a more democratic society. And I think in the same way, we're hopeful that the House next year will pass the surtax bill as a sign that, yes, we know we've got a problem and we are going to address it. Now, the Senate right now, I suspect, would not be wildly enthusiastic.
They're not jumping up and down and clicking their heels.
And our president probably has other things on his mind. So,
agreed.
Given that, obviously, the solution to both of those problems is going to vote.
Yes.
That's the solution. And if enough people, think that the time has come for a change, they'll go to the polls and we may have an outcome that allows these kinds of policies to be enacted. I think
vote,
it's possible.
Vote,
I'm obviously hopeful because
yes.
I'm spending a lot of time working on it.
Right, right. And it gives me hope, too. I knew that you were going to D.C. to help that bill get introduced. And people have to really get it that you do have power. I have power, and it's the vote. And boy, does it ever matter. There's a lot on the line in 2020 for my life and your life and everybody else's life, even the very rich. So I have last words, and you know I always have something to say, so here are my last words. As corny as this may sound, I really like Alan Davis. I haven't spent a great deal of time with him, but I've spent enough time to know he is a man with a mission. He is a person who cares deeply about any number of things, including the health and well-being of all the people living in our country. Alan gets it that a country with a strong middle class, a country who cares about the quality of education for all of its citizens, a country that cares about things like mortality rates and quality and accessible health care for everyone, is a strong country. It's a country that can be pointed out as a shining example to other nations around the world that a strong case can be made for a middle class that works. From where I sit, what our country really needs is more Alan Davises. More people with wealth and to varying degrees, more power to help us get to a place where I mean it when I say the last few words of the Pledge of Allegiance with liberty and justice for all, because I don't believe in that now. And for what me getting to a place where I believe that I finally live in a country that I can proudly call a democracy, because it really is one. Alan Davis, thanks for all your work.
Oh, thank you so much, Gina.
Thanks for letting me stay in your wonderful house. Don't give up. And thanks for showing up in my world and in Mrs. Green's world. This is going to be a podcast that lots of people listen to, and you've given us a lot to think about. And as always, I end with, to you, our listener, thanks for tuning in and for showing up. We need you. So, Alan, thank you. Thank you. Thank you. It was a great, great show.
Thank you, Gina. This is fantastic. Really appreciate it.